Sid Wilkes and the robber barons, straight to hell, the greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Jack Rasmus. The show, Alternative Visions. Today, we got a special show and special guests. In effect, what we got is a case study in our continuing series of discussions on this show on the subject of, quote, is American labor in unions at a strategic impasse? Unions and their workers in the U.S. have been battered now for more than three decades. Runaway shops, wage concessions, two-tier wage schedules, production and supervisory, non-supervisory production and service workers in this country today, if you look at them as a group, in other words, take out the managers, take out the professionals, their wages adjusted for inflation are the same as they were in 1982. Loss of benefits, shifting of health care costs, accelerating now with Obamacare, union negotiated health coverage here today about to disappear by 2018 when Obamacare slaps a 40% tax on these kind of negotiated health care plans, pensions being destroyed, replaced with phony 401ks that collapse every time there's a financial banking crisis. Union membership down from about 23% in 1980 to less than 7% today in the private sector. And free trade now on steroids accelerating as politicians rush to pass a Trans-Pacific Partnership free trade agreement and another in Europe. Concessions have become the norm in negotiations. Previously, the biggest unions have been pretty much exempt from this, but not any longer. Recently, over the weekend, we see this massive concession agreement with involving the Boeing workers in the Seattle area. An ominous shift and a worsening of the concession bargaining landscape. Last week, Boeing Corporation culminated a two-month effort demanding and getting massive concessions from its 31,000 International Association of Machinist workers. What does this mean? Well, it means, first of all, as I said, the biggest unions are no longer exempt from the process of concession bargaining. It means this deal is a template that corporations are now going to use. And if you don't believe me, just read the editorials in the Wall Street Journal coming out of this thing. They're all going to move in the same direction. Right. Now, what's also significant, strategic about this, that these are concessions made no longer because the company cries we can't afford it or we're about to go bankrupt with the airlines a few years ago, you know, and steel workers and so forth, and companies are going to go under, international competition. No, no, no. This is a situation now, a new shift and change of a company that is super fat, and they demand concessions because they can, not because they need it or justify it. For example, it just came out today. The profits at Boeing in its commercial plane division last year were $4.7 billion just in that division. Stock buybacks occurred in December. $10 billion in stock buybacks. Now, this is where the company goes and buys stock from its wealthy investors and pays them a premium. Another $2 billion on top of that in dividend payouts. And the commercial plane division has record orders going forward. And yet they demanded and got, as we'll see how, at talking with our guests, massive concessions. Now, what's interesting in this deal is what's the role of local political parties, national political parties, particularly Democrats, in putting pressure on the workers and also their own international union? And what's the problem with solidarity? Okay, what strategy is needed to stop this kind of ripoff is the key question. What's wrong with labor's industrial strategy, its bargaining strategy today that's been going backwards for three decades? Its organizing strategy, membership in collapse last year, 2012, labor lost 500,000 members while the economy added workers. What's wrong with the political strategy, the community alliances strategy? Well, we've been talking about that, but now we want to talk about a real practical example of all that. Let me introduce my guests here for you today. I've got three workers, actually, from the Boeing Corporation, people on the ground floor who have been experiencing this kind of ripoff. And I want to introduce them here and give a little background, and then we're going to let them tell their story. Okay, and I'm going to shut up, and let's hear it from the folks on the ground here. Okay, my first guest is Jim Levitt. Jim, and all of these guests, by the way, are long time employees, workers. At Boeing here. Jim Levitt is a 35-year veteran, works as a machinist, tool and die maker. He has been in the past also a member of Impact Visuals, a cooperatively owned photo agency specializing in labor and social change. And many of his photographs have appeared in AFL-CIO, IAM, Teamsters, other union publications, as well as Business Week, Time, New York Times, Labor Notes, and so forth. Right. My other guest is Shannon Riker, who began working at Boeing at 17, has been employed 8 years with the company as a final assembly installer in the 767 aircraft and a structures mechanic in the 777 aircraft divisions. Now, Shannon recently started a union support Facebook page called Rosie's Machinist 751, and when I have her say a few things here, she'll give you the reference of where to go. And there's more than 1,600 members now from the local who are on that Facebook page. And I also have Hazel Powers, who's a tooling inspector at Boeing, 55-year-old single parent, worked at Boeing for a number of years. She's an IAM District Council Alternative Delegate and has held past IAM Local Lodge positions as well. Okay, these are my three guests here. And I think listeners will find this illuminating. Okay, Jim, I'd like to have you take the ball and run with it first. Give us a background on the whole process here since November or before, after, how it all rolled out, what the issues were, and what's transpired from the time this attempt to extend the contract, which is now an 11-year contract. How did this come about? Take us up to the present, and then we'll have Hazel and Shannon jump in.
All right. I'll set the Wayback Machine a few years. We had a strike coming out of a contract coming out of a strike in 2008. Boeing responded to that by opening a second factory for the 787, their new plane, the Dreamliner, in South Carolina as a clear attempt to weaken union strength. That contract was slated to run until 2012. In 2011, Boeing comes along and says, we're going to do a new version of the 737, the best-selling airplane in history, and we will only place it in the Renton, Washington factory where 737s have always been built if the union agrees to extend the current contract. Which we wound up doing. That was in 2011. That contract, in retrospect, was not particularly onerous. The wage increases and whatever in there were much less than we had expected to get in 2012, but they did not come directly after our pension. They brought it up, we batted it back, and we managed to hold on to the defined benefit pension there. So we had a contract extension signed in 2011 to a contract that was supposed to run through 2012. That contract extension was supposed to run 4 years until September of 2016. Well, Boeing was getting ready to do a revamp of their other big cash cow, the 777, and they were going to use some new technology on it, make the wings out of composite fiber instead of aluminum. On the 787, those wings are made in Japan. The 787 has been a debacle. It's $20 to $30 billion over cost because of Boeing management's decision to outsource so much of the work on it. More of this was of the 777 was going to be done in-house, including the wings, or at least the wings were going to be done domestically. So Boeing, from what we are told, the International, the IAM International, got wind of the fact that Boeing was planning on building this plane somewhere other than Everett, Washington, where the 777 has been made and has been made extremely successfully. It's probably the most productive airplane assembly line in the world. So the union, from what we have heard, approached Boeing and said, hey, we're here, you're thinking about going someplace else. Let's talk about this. The union membership knew nothing of these talks. We first found out about this in November when we are presented with a proposal from the company to supposedly place the 777X work in the Puget Sound area and in Washington State as a whole. But in return, we were supposed to not only give up the defined benefit pension that we have had for decades, but new hires would be coming in at sharply reduced pay rates. They were going to stretch out the progression step system where new hires get 50 cents an hour more every 6 months for 6 years and then jump to the full rate in their pay grade. They were going to get rid of what's called the Zoom after 6 years and keep new hires just moving along at 50 cents more every 6 months. It was going to take new hires 20 to 25 years to reach maximum rates in their pay grades. Compared to a current new hire, that was going to cost future hires about $200,000 each in lifetime earnings.
What would be the start rate for the new hires?
It varies. There are 11 pay grades. There's actually 12. They run from 1 to 11. There's a lower pay grade, A. I use a grade 4 as an example because it's one of our most heavily populated pay grades. They start at $15 an hour. The maximum rate up until the latest cost of living was $35.25. That $15 an hour start rate, incidentally, the start rates, the minimum rates, have only changed once since 1992. And under the terms of this offer that Boeing brought, those minimum rates were going to remain frozen until 2024. It was going to be so bad that the lowest pay grades, which start at $11, $12, $13, $14 an hour, by the time this contract would be over in 2024, would be lower than the minimum rate, the minimum wage in Washington State, which is indexed to inflation, whereas these minimum rates were not. That offer was so outrageous in November that even with the International essentially pushing us to accept it and forcing our local district leadership to remain officially neutral on this, we did not get a recommendation to vote yes or vote no on this, which created great confusion among the union membership. We voted that proposal down 2-1 on November 13th. And things went quiet for several weeks on that. But there was a massive, massive public campaign to put pressure on us to accept a deal with Boeing and to accept these concessions. We had the governor, a Democrat, who had been endorsed by our union. Our union had been campaigning for him, saying this was a huge missed opportunity for Washington. And there were virtually every politician in the state from top to bottom, with very few exceptions, was out there saying that we needed to save the state. We had to save the children. We had to save the aerospace economy in Washington State. Without us approving this contract, the sky would fall. Well, meanwhile, Boeing went out and solicited bids from something like 55 other localities, and they were asking for, the audacity of it was unbelievable. They were asking for free land, free or low-cost facilities, maybe even including the machinery. They wanted tax breaks, road improvements, rail, ports, this, that, everything else. Essentially what they wanted was for other states and other localities to give them upwards of $10 billion worth of facilities to replicate what already exists here in the Puget Sound, in the Everett, Washington facility and in the other Boeing facilities that are here. That was obviously a pressure campaign against us to say, well, if you people don't accept these concessions, we're just going to leave.
So it wasn't just the politicians in Washington state putting pressure on you guys, but politicians elsewhere in the country joining in, a kind of a national political pressure campaign here on you guys to give up some very important provisions in your contract. Now, besides the reducing the start wage to below minimum wage and ending your defined benefit pensions, for all practical purposes, what else was in an 11-year contract? What else is in this contract deal?
Well, one, it's not written down in paper in the contract, but the effect of this contract would be to end collective bargaining for all intents and purposes. We would, if we are locked into a contract as we were this time round, we have no potential to strike if the company brings us a completely unacceptable offer. We're tied and committed to a no-strike pledge through 2016 before this latest vote, whereas the company could threaten, well, give us these things right now or we're leaving town.
So, in other words, when Obamacare hits union-negotiated health care provisions with a 40% excise tax in 2018, Boeing can come in and say, well, we're having to get rid of, or you pay all of the 40% excise tax increase.
Yes, that is in fact in this contract. Besides increases in our co-pays and our monthly payments towards health care, which will roughly triple for employees over the life of this contract. There is a clause in there that says Boeing can unilaterally adjust these medical plans to avoid paying these excise taxes. So when that rolls around in 2017, 2018, the union has no say in what is going to happen to our health care costs. So there could be a very, and there will be, a very nasty surprise coming. It's a ticking time bomb. The medical costs could go much higher.
Any other dramatic provision changes that listeners should be aware of in this agreement? And then conclude the whole process that you were starting there.
Shannon and Hazel may remember some more of the other little joys that are
okay. Well, let's move on to Shannon. Shannon, okay. You're there, and tell us what happened after this first vote that was turned down by a huge margin by the workers there, 31,000 of them. What happened that got you folks back into a forced a second vote?
Well, there was a lot of pressure from outside political sources, a lot of local, state, and government officials got involved and started media campaigns trying to push us back to the table with Boeing. And as a result of that, we also had some union members who were also pushing for the revote and for a, for us to go back to the table. When that finally happened and the union approached Boeing with a counter offer, Boeing came back with another offer that was nowhere near what the union was offering and basically again told us, take it or leave it. And at that point, the union walked away and said, no, there's too many concessions. We can't accept that. This isn't different. This isn't much different from what you proposed and we already said no to in November, and as a result, the union walked away, but then that angered people. That angered state and local officials. That angered some of the union membership who thought that they should have a chance to vote on that contract. The majority of us still felt like it was too similar to the one that we had just voted down, so we were fine with the union's decision, to not vote on that contract. But as a result of the local officials, and they started letter-writing campaigns, they put out ads in local newspapers, putting pressure on our union and our membership to vote on this new contract proposal. And eventually that pressure paid off, and our international stepped in on the Friday that most of our membership left for, so our membership went on Christmas vacation on that Friday, and then that next Saturday they announced that we would be revoting on a contract after most people started vacation.
Who headed up the union negotiating team? Was it your international office here, or was it the local folks? Who was actually talking directly with management? And as I understand it from what Jim said, it was the international union that initiated trying to reopen this contract that wouldn't expire anyway until 2016. Is that correct? It was the international that did this?
That's our understanding on it, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So who headed up, Shannon, the actual negotiations while most of the members were on vacation that resulted in let's open it up and have another vote, essentially the same vote a second time?
Well, that actually happened prior to our members going on vacation.
Okay.
The week prior to was when the company and the union re-entered talks, and there was a our union presented a proposal, the company presented a counter proposal, and at that time our union, and I believe at that time it was the local union leadership that walked away and said, no, there's too many concessions. We aren't going to vote on that.
So the international went back after the local walked away and started discussing once again.
Sitting in on all these negotiations and supposedly the lead for our side was Rich Michalski, who is a retired general vice president of the international. He had been the legislative director for the international and had co-lobbied with Boeing's lobbyists to win the Air Force tanker contract, for example. He was hired by the international, we've heard, for hundreds of thousands of dollars. He set up a consulting firm after he retired from the international. He was hired by the international to come and supposedly lead these talks. This is exceedingly strange because the international has aerospace coordinators. We have other elected staff people. And we have our local leadership that is elected. We had a completely unelected outside person was leading these talks nominally on our side. And at every turn, he would come out and put the cheeriest possible spin on Boeing's proposals. It was stabbing us in the back virtually at every turn. And he was the one who came out of that meeting when our local leadership said, no, we are not bringing this second Boeing proposal to a vote. Boeing had come in with this proposal and said, this is only a proposal if you recommend acceptance to your members. If you don't do that, then we're taking the proposal off the table. And our local leadership said, well, then there is no offer. Boeing literally picked up the offer sheets and walked out of the room. Rich Michalski came out and spoke to the Seattle Times within a half hour of that occurring and said, we're going to vote on that second offer.
Oh, without discussing whether the membership wanted to vote on the second
yes.
offer.
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting. Like they already made a decision.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
And the timing of it was extremely suspicious because we have a negotiated 10-day break from right before Christmas through right after New Year's. We were due back on January 2nd, January 3rd. Many, many, many workers take a couple of days of vacation, the one day before we're supposed to start and the 2 days after, to get a 16-day uninterrupted vacation. So this second contract vote was announced when many people had already left, and the vote was to be held before thousands of our members would even be back.
Yep.
Shannon or Hazel, you want to comment on that?
That is one of the sticking points for our membership at this time, is the timing of the vote. We believe that that was done in bad faith on the part of our international. They knew that that was the case. They knew that a majority of the people who would be able to take that time off were people who were strong union people and had been through the process many times before. And that left a lot of the younger population and new hires without the mentorship of the older population to say, hey, this is what we've done in the past. This is how we operate now. And so it kind of left them without the guide. And a lot of people were blind and didn't even realize what was happening, what was going on. If you were on vacation out of town or out of the country, you probably had no knowledge that this had even occurred, and you probably didn't even know that there was an absentee, that you were able to go in and vote absentee ballot, because it's something that had never happened before.
Yeah, I don't know how accurate these numbers are, but what I've read is that 8,000 of the 31,000 didn't vote in the second vote.
That's
a huge number, and the thing is passed by only 600 votes.
Yeah, a swing of 300 votes made the difference.
Yeah.
Wow, there's something that came out just in the last day that I think gives a hint as to why there was that rush to hold that vote on January 3rd. All the union members were saying, wait a minute, why can't we just wait until the 5th or the 6th or whatever? What's the big deal? Three more days. Well, Boeing had already announced that it was going to give its annual report detailing its sales and orders for 2013. That was scheduled to occur on January 7th. And when they did, a very interesting little tidbit appeared. When the 777X was first announced and opened for sales at the Dubai Air Show back in November, Boeing announced something like 270 orders for that plane, made a huge splash on it.
Right, record orders, and they also announced the $4.7 billion profit.
No, that came out yesterday. But back in November, they announced that they had 270-something orders for this plane. And huge, huge orders. Now, what the union membership had been saying was, after the 787 disaster, Boeing is years late on this plane, is literally tens of billions of dollars over cost on this plane because of management's decision to outsource so much of it, that the airlines were demanding that this new plane, this 777X, be built where they could count on it being built on time and correctly. And that place is Everett. There were even some, the heads of two of the very major buyers among the airlines, Emirates was one of them, said, do not do to us what you did on the 787. And we figured the subtext of that was they're telling Boeing, build this in Everett. That was our leverage in this, because we had no ability to strike. Well, now it turns out that there weren't, in fact, 270-something orders for this plane. There were only 66 firm orders for this plane. In other words, the airlines that signed on the dotted line and put down some money. And the Seattle Times reporter actually came out and said in his article, talking about this yesterday, that many of the airlines were probably waiting to make sure that the plane was built in Everett before they would commit to it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, had that information been public before we voted on the second contract offer, it would have strengthened the union hand tremendously, because the union membership would have understood.
Yeah. And I understand, if I can add to that, that the company is not all that satisfied with the non-union South Carolina facility's production record, and it's also dissatisfied with the Japan wing production. So the company was really kind of, it seems to me, planning to move back production to Seattle anyway, not the opposite. I'd like to give Hazel a chance here to talk, but first, Hazel, hold on. We're going to take a very short announcement break here, and then we're going to come back, and you jump in, Hazel, and fill in the gaps here, whatever you want to say that hasn't been said so far. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus, the show's Alternative Vision. My guest, the Boeing workers, will be back shortly, and we'll continue this important discussion.
Here we stood the drum. Now we'll stand the flood.
This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show Alternative Visions, and today we're talking with Boeing workers on the massive concessions they've been forced to accept over this past weekend, which an editorial today in a Wall Street Journal has described as, quote, the most important business story of 2014, unquote. And to carry it on here, also a further quote from this Wall Street Journal editorial, quote, just about every elected Democrat and other official in the state of Washington essentially demanded that the union vote again and accept Boeing's terms. That includes Democratic Governor Jay Inslee, the mayors of Seattle and Everett, the executive of Snohomish County, state and federal legislatures, and a conspicuously involved U.S. Senator Patty Murray, unquote. So the pressure on the poor Boeing workers was massive, and it seems to me that there were some shenanigans going on by the international union negotiators behind the scenes to not only open this whole process in the beginning, but when they didn't get the vote they liked, to sort of maneuver in the back door in a timely fashion when everybody was away to push through another vote. Now, you know, you can understand how the members of the IAM local there would get discouraged with everybody aligned against them. Hazel, why don't you jump in and tell us, you know, what is the mood of the membership, local union membership there in the wake of this decision? And clarify for us, too, what's the role of the local union leaders? From what's been said so far, it looks like, you know, they weren't all that happy and supportive of the international union's maneuvers here, and we're caught between a rock and a hard place. How is the local IAM membership? There's like three or four unions, isn't there, local unions? They call them lodges in the IAM. Yeah. Explain their role in this whole process, and then jump in and tell us what's the mood of the folks now.
Okay, Jack, thank you. So as far as the local lodge memberships, we have local A, C, F, E in our district, as well as Eastern Washington, Portland, and Wichita. Those work groups all make up our District 751. And it's my understanding, and I was sitting in the district council when our district president Tom Robleski explained to us what had happened, as Shannon and Jim had already described, when we had already rejected the vote in November, and then in December the company called the union and said, can we talk? We want to see what it would take to get you back to the table, what it would take to get us closer together. So the union, our local union leadership, agreed to meet with the company to talk. And after that discussion, our union presented the company with a counterproposal of what our union felt would be a fair contract proposal. And the company came back with the counterproposal that we voted on. Our union leadership, the district president and the business reps were all together with the company representatives, and just like Jim and Shannon had described, the company said, here's the proposal that we are going to offer you, but it's only on the table under the condition that you, district president Tom Robleski, and your business reps go out and sell it to your members. That's the condition that this proposal is on the table. And our district president and business reps said, no way, we will not go out and advocate for this new proposal because, number one, it's too close to the one that our membership rejected by 67% in November. And number two, it has the concessions of the defined pension plan that would end in 2016. After that, the pension would migrate to a basic 401k plan, 10% of your salary the first year, 6% the second year, and 4% leveling off thereafter. Any new hire coming into the company would only get 4%. If you're not currently employed at the company, you would only get 4%. So our union leadership said we will not advocate for this proposal.
It sounds like they just moved the money around and gave you the same offer.
Yeah, they took off the one most... they took off the ending the progression step Zoom, where they were going to stretch things out for 20 to 25 years. So instead of taking 25 years to get the max rate, it remained at 6.
Oh, by the new hire vote.
Yeah, but that's what we've had for decades. So all they did was take back a takeaway. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it was the same.
Okay, continue, Hazel.
And so the local leadership said, we won't advocate for it. So the company removed the proposal. They, like Jim said, they literally took the piece of paper off the table and said, well, if you won't advocate, then there is no proposal. And that's what our union leadership explained and tried to tell the members. Mm-hmm. We won't advocate for it because we don't agree with it. It's not a good deal. It's not something we want. We would recommend to our membership. So the company removed the proposal. There's nothing to vote on. There is nothing to vote on because the company withdrew it. But that's not how it was reported.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how the media got a hold of it.
Yep.
And instantly...
So the second vote, allow me to clarify this for our listeners. So the second vote was a vote called with sort of strange timing here by your international union on a proposal that had been withdrawn by the company? Is that the story?
That's correct.
The company came back supposedly and removed that requirement that
mm-hmm.
our local leadership advocate for it.
Mm.
So all of a sudden, the international could say there's a proposal on the table.
I see, I see. Well, it sounds to me, you know, I've been a union member a long time, and I've been scores of contracts I've negotiated. It sounds to me like they tried to get your local leadership to recommend this, and when you wouldn't, you walked away, they called up your international and said, hey, would you guys put this to a vote? But maybe that's just my suspicion here. Well, okay, so we know the issues here. We know the process. It comes to a second vote here on a very strange timing. On January 3rd, instead of 6, 8,000 members did not get to vote because of the timing on all this. It barely passes. What's the, Hazel, what's the mood of your members now after this debacle?
The members have started petitions at our local lodge meetings. They are calling for a revote. They've started petitions. The day of the vote... they voted at each union hall. We have union halls located in Everett, Renton, Auburn, Seattle, Fredrickson, Portland, Wichita. The different union halls were the voting places. And one of my union brothers called me that night and said, sister, this morning, on the way, at 5 o'clock in the morning, the vote started. On the way in, the streets were lined, literally lined with hundreds of people holding up signs saying, please vote yes. Please save the Washington economy. Please. And he said, sister, it was like when you have a political campaign and you have the people standing on the street corner with the signs saying, vote for such and such politician. They had wives and community people and children standing out in the street corners. Please vote yes, as the members were going to cast their ballots.
Well, were these other union members holding these signs? Who was who mobilized these people to come out and politic in front of your voting booth or whatever? Do you have any idea?
Well, so some of our members are pretty savvy, and they investigated, and, you know, it's I don't have any hard facts and data proof, but what I heard, the rumor is that this group was actually organized by a political, so-called political group, but it was ultimately, if you get down to it, the bottom line, ultimately funded by people that have interest with the Boeing company.
Mm-hmm.
And the politicians, you know, it can all be traced back. They were funded, and they were, you know, a call to arms to support this. And like we had said, we had such undue pressure from the politicians, from the community. The sky was literally falling.
Mm-hmm. Can I add to that?
Yes, please, please, Shannon, jump in.
So she's talking about all the people who were standing on the corners with signs, and that there was a political group that was intervening, and all of that is actually absolutely correct. And the other thing that I witnessed running my Rosie page was that there was a group called Keep It in Washington that had started campaigning and purchasing ads on Facebook that kept popping up in people who were Boeing employees or people who were in aerospace or unions. Those ads were also purchased. So if you were to go and try to find IAN751 website, the very first thing that would pop up when you type that in the URL to find the IAN's website was the Keeping It in Washington campaign. That was that popped up even above our own lodge's information. So they were actively campaigning against us. They were placing newspaper ads. They papered our entire Everett plant. Hundreds and hundreds of flyers were posted all over our Everett plant so that when people came back from their break, they had vote yes signs from this organization hanging on the walls everywhere.
Well, that sounds very interesting. Somebody has a community strategy here, mobilizing the community against the workers, which kind of raises, the question, what does labor have in terms of a community strategy, building alliances and support? But that's another question. Okay, that's a very interesting development. Somebody paid a lot of money to...
There was an AstroTurf organization posters here that had billboards and signs.
Yeah, somebody ought to investigate that a little further. Dig down in and see who was really behind. I suspect you'll find the company and other right-wing supporters, and maybe even some other Democratic politicians who looked the other way or supported that as well.
I went back to look into that a little bit post-vote. And mysteriously, all the ads and the website that was all established on is all gone now.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Jack, this is unprecedented that our international intervened. Like Jim said, we had a contract. Well, we had a contract that was good until 2016.
So they opened it up. They opened a can of worms to begin with. Why did they do that? Any ideas why they would want to open this thing up when you had three or four years to go on your contract?
Well, we did have an unusual situation here, that Boeing was going to make a decision late in 2013 or early in 2014 where to build this next plane. And included in building the next plane is a new factory to build the composite fiber wing. There is no such facility in the United States now. The only one that exists is Mitsubishi's in Japan. So if we wanted to make sure that our members were doing this work, I don't see that there was really any way for us to not discuss it with Boeing.
Mm-hmm.
The problem, as I see it, is that the International opened these talks up in secret. For all we know, it was just our District Lodge President, Tom Rebluski, who was aware that these talks were going on. I don't even know that the rest of the elected leaders of our 31,000 members here were aware that these talks were going on. This was all being done behind closed doors, so it came as a total surprise. And it removes any of the strength that we have, which is that of an educated, aware, mobilized membership. It's mm-hmm. just one guy in a suit, supposedly on our side, talking to some guys in suits on Boeing's side about our futures. And there was no democratic inclusion of the union membership in this.
What I find interesting is that, you know, this main theme that, oh, you know, if you don't make concessions, we're going to move away, seems to be contrary to some of the evidence that is now coming out. But let me quote this editorial in the Wall Street Journal again, where the writer says, quote, Boeing was already known to be dissatisfied with the dispersed plane making that currently has the 787's wing made in Japan. Boeing's own new 787 plant with non-union workers in South Carolina has been slow to get up to speed. That seems contrary to the whole idea that if you don't make concessions, we're going to move the work.
And Jack, not only that, if not all, the majority of the airplanes that have been produced or assembled at the 787 plant in South Carolina have had to come to Everett, Washington for us to fix. So that they are flyable.
What's the production rate in South Carolina versus Everett?
South Carolina produced 14 planes this year.
14. And how many did Everett produce?
On the 787, I don't know how many they're producing up there. What is it, about 7 a month now? Something
yes.
like
yeah. 10 or 10.
Yeah, they're moving towards 10. But overall, Boeing is producing 55 or 56 airplanes a month, company-wide. One comes from Charleston, South Carolina.
So, and from our last contract, the 787 plant in South Carolina, we, the union, filed a National Labor Relations charge against the company because the Boeing company publicly made statements that said they're intentionally building that plant so that they will not have to face the labor disputes that they face in the Puget Sound area. And the charges were substantiated by the National Labor Relations Board.
Mm-hmm.
Mm, okay.
And the union dropped those charges as part of the contract extension in 2011.
To settle mm-hmm. the strike, yes.
I see. Anyone else want to jump in and say, what's the mood of your membership now? Let's pick up that topic once again. What, you know, how do the workers up there feel about all this at this point? And is there any discussion about, you know, how can we prevent this or what should we do to try to reverse this?
So can I add something about the South Carolina thing before
sure,
we move
ahead.
On to the next topic? So
yes.
My site has allowed me to talk to members from every Boeing site in the U.S. And I've talked to many members who are workers at South Carolina and talked about the rates. And they have expressed to me that they want our help and that they want us to come there and help them and do things that they can't do down there, and that there's a lack of tribal knowledge that they have there. So they're straggling along. But the division that Boeing has created between union and non-union is so strong, they will not allow us to go down there to help them. And instead, they're bringing in contract workers to help fix the problem. And then eventually, when that doesn't work, they're flying those planes to Everett to have them fixed here, because they would rather fly them to Everett and have them fixed here than take workers who are unionized and expose them to non-union workers in South Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, that's very typical. Companies don't want the union workers talking to their non-union workers because they may convince them to organize. Sure.
So in essence, they are creating the problem in South Carolina, but not by not allowing their experienced membership to go down there and kind of help them out to get the ball rolling and to teach them better processes for the build.
Before we move on, Shannon, give us your Rosie's website or where people can go if they want to join
so
in the discussion.
If you're on Facebook, you can go to Rosie's with an S, Machinist with an S, 751. And that was, it's all one word mashed together. Mm-hmm. And type that in the search bar, and it will bring it up, and you'll see a picture of Rosie the Riveter.
And how many people do you have accessing that?
As of this morning, I have 1,601.
So, sounds like a good site. Okay.
So, there is, I have to warn you now, there is a fake page that someone has created in an effort to distract members from trying to find my page. So, if you find a Rosie's Machinist page with only one like, that is not my page, and please retype it in as one solid word, and you should be able to find the one, the correct one.
Okay. Well, let's go back to Hazel and Jim. What's the mood of the membership, and what's the discussion, if anything, on what to do next? Hazel?
Well, like I said, the members have started petitions on the floor. They have started, they have gone to the local lodge meetings. The meetings are being held this week and next week at the local lodge meetings, and they're asking the local lodge presidents and ultimately the district presidents with these petitions to let's have a revote, because typically when we have a contract, we go out and we educate our members and we explain to them what the concessions are or what the proposals are of the contract, and we have the time to go out and educate the members to make an informed decision when they go in and vote for a contract. That's typically how it happens when we have a contract here. But in this case, we didn't have the time to do that because basically this was a surprise vote for us.
And everybody mm-hmm. was on vacation.
Yes.
Well, what's the response of the international to a vote recount? It seems to me that it was pretty darn close, only 600 votes, but 8,000 folks not getting the chance to vote. Why wouldn't they have a revote?
Well, the international wanted this contract to pass. That was clear. Rich Mihalski came out in the Seattle Times after this passed and said, it's sunny days in Seattle for the next 40 to 50 years. It was enough to make one gag. I'm concerned with what I'm seeing and hearing on the shop floor. I'm in amongst a group of predominantly older, higher skilled, higher paid members, so I can't say that it's a representative group. I'm hoping that Shannon and Hazel will have a better feel for this. But there is talk of people wanting to withdraw from the union because they think the union sold us out on this. In the case of the international, it's kind of hard to argue against that. So we have some initial work to do just to keep everybody focused on the fact that it was Boeing was out to screw us here, and that we need to strengthen our union, not to rip it apart. There is a campaign to replace Buffenbarger as the international president. It will be the first contested election for president of the IAM in 50 years, and that's only coming as a result of a court order. So, of course, there's going to be some focus on that. But among the broader union membership, the people who are not necessarily those who go to union meetings and whatever, I don't really know what the feel is. I'm not in a big factory like Shannon is up in Everett. I'm in a kind of a smaller side.
Well, Shannon, you tell us, what's the mood up there?
People are outraged. They're absolutely outraged about the timing of the vote. They're outraged that the vote even happened when our local leadership clearly said that it was not a contract that we should be voting on. They are angry that the international intervened and overstepped their bounds and forced that vote. And the timing is really one of the biggest issues that it's just ticked people off. And so there is active, people are actively filing an LRB complaint. At this point, I believe there are 6 active complaints against the company and the union. I also know that there are many people who are preparing their complaints and in the process of getting ready to file them.
there was several carloads of members that went today down to that office to file complaints.
I'm going to have to intervene. Sorry, Shannon. I wish we could run your whole thought there, but we're getting signals that we're at the end of our show here. So I want to thank you all for this great interview. And, you know, I wish you all the best of luck. And, you know, what this Boeing shows is that there's something dramatically wrong with Labor's political strategy. That's for darn sure, with all the Democrats opposed and to the workers and in favor of the company. There's something wrong with the bargaining strategy that would allow the international to have so much more control over the local negotiators. And there's something going on here with the community alliances. It looks like Boeing has a strategy in that regard, and the labor and the union did not. So we're going to continue this discussion of, you know, is labor at a strategic impasse, and do we need to relook at all these elements of union strategy going forward? But thank you again, and I hope people get to hear your story, the workers and the Boeing workers IAM local union story here in this important event, because this is going to be a template for other unions going forward, and, you know, the business press is saying so itself. So, thank you once again, all of you. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.